Hello, and welcome back to ACRAC. I'm Jed Wolpaw, and I'm very excited because I have back with me again our pharmacist extraordinaire, Rachel Kruer, who you will remember from when we did Bugs and Drugs Part 1, and she just did a fantastic overview for us of different bugs and drugs and what you need to think about, especially for the surgical ICU. And now Rachel is back, and we are going to go over common infections that you will find in the surgical ICU and how to address them. Rachel, welcome back.
Thanks. I'm happy to be here.
All right. So let's jump right in. How do you think about, or how do you categorize in your mind the common surgical ICU infections?
Well, certainly we encounter all kinds of infections in the surgical ICU, but probably the most common infections that we see are intra-abdominal infections, and then pneumonia and urinary tract infections. Certainly that list isn't all-encompassing, but when we're selecting antibiotics, it's really important to consider what the source of infection is, because we need to think about what organisms are most commonly associated with that source, and also if we're able to obtain good tissue penetration and concentrations when we're selecting antibiotics.
Right. I think that's huge. And we mentioned this in our last episode we did together, that the minimum inhibitory concentration that you get, your MICs, is going to be in a test tube. You have to know what's going to happen in the body to make an appropriate selection. And so we want to make sure we do that. So when you make an initial selection, you're going to, as you said, look at the site of infection and what is causing the problem. You also want to look at whether it came, like you mentioned last time, from the community or in the hospital. Are there other things you think about?
Yeah, so I think we've sort of hit on all these, but just to sort of put the list together, when we're thinking about empiric therapy, my first question is always, what's the site that we're concerned about? Antimicrobials should be selected based on the suspected site and the pathogens associated with that site. And then the severity of illness, if a patient is in septic shock, we have less room for error. We know from previous studies that risk of mortality decreases with the shorter amount of time to appropriate antibiotics. So we want to make sure that we're not missing what the organism could be. And then community versus hospital acquired. If we have a patient who's coming from home, from the community, we're going to be less concerned about things like Pseudomonas, probably MRSA, depending on what part of the country you're in. But if we have a patient who's been in the hospital for a while, those organisms are going to be higher on the list for sure.
Great. And then we hear a lot, oh, should we narrow? Should we narrow our antibiotics? So how do you decide when to narrow antibiotic therapy?
I think the short answer is that absolutely antimicrobial therapy should be narrowed. It should be tailored once the source has been controlled and susceptibilities are known. Vancomycin should be stopped if resistant gram-positive organisms are not recovered. And this is really important with our stewardship efforts, because we talked a lot the last time about resistance that's developing, and probably one of the biggest things that we have control over is to avoid using those broad-spectrum agents when they're not necessary.
Great. I totally agree. All right. Let's start with intra-abdominal infections, certainly some of the most common we see in the surgical ICU. How do you think about those and categorize them in your head?
Yeah, so I think about, so the GI tract is quite expansive, and the organisms that you encounter at different portions of the GI tract are actually a little bit different. And so understanding where the infection is within the GI tract is an important component of to think about which organisms are going to be most common. So if we start from the top, if you will, and think about intraoral infections, this is where you're going to be primarily concerned about Streptococcus, maybe Neisseria, Peptostreptococcus, intraoral anaerobes, for example. Then as you move down to the esophagus, it's actually fairly sparse flora. Again, strep and peptostreptococcus would be concerns here. The actual other colonizing organism that you would be concerned about if you had, for example, an esophageal perforation would be Candida species. So including antifungal coverage with an esophageal perforation would be something that you would want to consider. If you think about the stomach, actually the pH of the stomach is quite low, and so there's actually very limited colonization in the stomach itself. It does contain some anaerobes, but the other thing that you would think about if you had a gastric perforation would be H. pylori. So that's something that's different. So probably you would cover anaerobes, gram negatives, and then consider whether or not H. pylori is a possible culprit here if you were considering a gastric perforation. Thinking about the biliary tree, mostly gram-negatives here, perhaps some enterococcus and anaerobes would be what you would cover for an infection that was biliary in nature. And then as you move down the GI tract from moving into the small bowel and then further into the colon, the amount of bacterial colonization increases with the distance from the stomach as the pH changes. And so here in the small bowel, you would be concerned about gram-negative organisms, also Enterococcus, Clostridium species, Bacteroides, perhaps even Candida, and then with the colon, Enterococcus would certainly be a principal organism there.
Great. All right. So now let's start maybe with the biliary tract. And the common things we hear are cholecystitis, cholangitis. So how do we think about those things and how do we treat them?
In general, cholecystitis and cholangitis can be treated relatively similarly from an antimicrobial selection standpoint. If the patient is coming from the community with community-acquired cholecystitis or community-acquired cholangitis, these and the patients are presenting with mild to moderate severity of illness, something like ertapenem would be a good option. You could also consider a fluoroquinolone like ciprofloxacin plus metronidazole. In patients who have a severe presentation or who are immunocompromised, these patients, so if they're coming to the ICU in septic shock, for example, in these patients, we would want to be sure that we're not missing something. And so these are patients who empirically we would start on piperacillin, tazobactam. If they had a penicillin allergy, you might consider ciprofloxacin or estreonam plus metronidazole. Remember, though, that if you're using ciprofloxacin or estreonam, there really is no good gram-positive coverage, and so you might include vancomycin in these regimens, especially if the patient's in septic shock. You may not really need vancomycin for a patient who's coming from the community, even if they're severely ill or immunocompromised, because it's not likely that MRSA would be an organism that you would be concerned about here.
Okay, and then what about acute cholangitis?
Acute cholangitis of any severity, you would probably start with piperacillin, tazobactam, and then again for a patient with a severe penicillin allergy, ciprofloxacin or estreonam plus metronidazole. This would also be a patient that may have a bilioenteric anastomosis. And then for patients that have a healthcare-acquired biliary infection of any severity, again, you would use these same antibiotics.
Great. And the other thing I would add is, you know, one of the issues with cholangitis is that there's a lot of pressure often in the biliary tree. And so the reason it's common to get bacteremia is because that pressure is built up and it's actually just, in a way, pushing the bacteria into the bloodstream. And so really relieving the pressure is sometimes the only way to stop getting more bacteremia. And so this is where percutaneous biliary drains can actually be the only thing that can help if you have repeated bouts of cholangitis without and bacteremia without being able to effectively treat it with antibiotics. Sometimes you have to get that drainage in there to relieve that pressure. All right. So how about peritonitis? That's kind of a catch-all that we see not infrequently. How do you think about that?
Peritonitis does, like you said, it's a fairly broad term. And so thinking about whether peritonitis is primary, secondary, or tertiary can be helpful in determining which antibiotics would be most appropriate. So primary peritonitis, this is what we're talking about here is spontaneous infection of the peritoneal cavity. So this is usually associated with ascites and liver failure. Versus secondary peritonitis is infection of the peritoneal cavity due to spillage of organisms into the peritoneum, frequently seen with perforation, and then tertiary being recurrent infection of the peritoneal cavity following an episode of secondary peritonitis.
Okay. So probably let's start with secondary since that's probably what we see most commonly. And what causes secondary peritonitis?
Usually a perforation, usually a gastric perforation or a perforation of the small bowel or the colon. We talked about, considering for gastric perforation treatment of H. pylori if the patient does demonstrate that they're H. pylori positive. In the small bowel, we talked about, really being concerned about gram-negatives and anaerobes, where in the colon, more concerned about Candida, anaerobes, gram-negative bacteria, and then Enterococcus being a heavy colonizer of the colon.
Okay, great. And then what makes it harder? Sometimes you're kind of trying to get source control and it's difficult or you're not having an effective response to your antibiotics. How do we think of what patients are at high risk for that?
Yeah, the patients who have been identified as high risk of failure to gain source control are those who have had a delayed in intervention. So patients who have not gone to the OR within 24 hours of identification of a perforation. Those of advanced age, those with a high severity of illness, so, you know, high Apache 2 score greater than 15. If they have a lot of comorbidities and high degree of organ dysfunction, low albumin, poor nutritional status, the degree of peritoneal involvement it can be a confounding factor. And then the presence of malignancy.
Okay, great. So you'd mentioned tertiary peritonitis. How do we identify that?
Usually you guys are telling me if we are dealing with tertiary peritonitis because of evidence on the CT scan. So usually this is these are patients who have had a fistula form, those who have dusky bowel, or those where there's evidence of an abscess in the abdomen.
Okay. And the concern is these often are colonized with resistant organisms.
Yeah, because often these patients have been treated for secondary peritonitis already. Perhaps they were started on piperacillin and tazobactam because a perforation was identified, and they were started on piptazo as soon as they got to the ICU. And then because of those risk factors that we talked about, we weren't able to obtain source control very quickly. And then an abscess forms, and that's when we really become concerned that potentially these patients are going to have a resistant pathogen.
Great. So, Rachel, often when I go to you and I say, you know, what do you think we should do for a course of antibiotics here, you have some great questions that you come back at us with. So tell me, what are those questions and why do we ask them?
And remember, my questions are coming from a person who wasn't in the operating room and is also not reading the CT scan, but I'm not going to ask questions like, what did it look like in there in the operating room? What did the surgical team report? What did they find? Were cultures sent? Did they get it out? Do they think they've did the surgeons feel like they obtained source control? Do they have drains in place, or is the abdomen still open and there's just a wound back? Did the patient come from home, or did they come from upstairs, a different floor in the hospital? Did they have recent antibiotic exposure? Were they on something already on the floor or at home? And what's the patient look like now? How sick are they? Are they on vasopressors, or are they on room air and they're hemodynamically stable? Those might influence what antibiotics we're going to choose.
Absolutely. And the only other one I'd add is probably, do they have any indwelling hardware, which certainly can be a big factor too.
Absolutely.
All right. So when we think about mild to moderate community-acquired intra-abdominal infections, give me some examples of those and then how we would treat them.
Yeah, similar to cholecystitis, you could, for these patients as well, choose ertapenem as a first-line option. You could also consider a combination of a third-generation cephalosporin like ceftriaxone in addition to metronidazole, or a fluoroquinolone like ciprofloxacin in addition to metronidazole.
Great. And so what might someone come in with from the community? What would you put in this category of kind of a mild to moderate intra-abdominal infection?
So this might be a patient who came in for an EGD and subsequently had a complication. There was a perforation that occurred during the procedure, and they subsequently went to the operating room within 12 hours or so. And so we would treat them for peritonitis probably for a really short course, but they didn't have any risk factors for a resistant organism.
Got it. Great. And so you mentioned ertapenem, moxifloxacin, and then if you were going to do a combination, you might do metronidazole along with something else?
Yep, with the third-generation cephalosporin, or something like ceftriaxone plus metronidazole, or ciprofloxacin in combination with metronidazole. You know, the guidelines do recommend that moxifloxacin is a good option. That's not something that I would consider at this point as a first-line agent, just because the anaerobic coverage isn't as good. So I might actually use ciprofloxacin that might have a little bit better gram-negative coverage, but also add metronidazole to that regimen.
Great. So let's talk about more severely ill people. So let's say someone coming in, they're high risk, they're severely ill with a community-acquired intra-abdominal infection. How does that differ from what we just talked about, which was the kind of mild to moderate intra-abdominal infection acquired in the community?
For these patients, so these are your patients who are going to be presenting with severe sepsis or septic shock. And so we would want to make sure that we were covering the organisms that they have. And while Pseudomonas isn't necessarily a pathogen that we would be highly concerned about, we would want to be sure that we didn't miss anything. And the other thing to think about is that these patients are often very vasodilated. They have very large volumes of distribution. They're also going to be getting a lot of fluid resuscitation. And so drugs like ertapenem, for example, or ceftriaxone have don't have huge volumes of distribution, and their half-lives are relatively short. And so we would want to use something that we would be more comfortable in, especially in a very severely ill patient, obtaining adequate time above the MIC, sort of drawing back on what we learned in the first session. So for these patients, we would use piperacillin tazobactam. If the patient had a mild, I would say, penicillin allergy, so a rash, not anaphylaxis, then you might consider using a cephalosporin like cefepime in addition to metronidazole or even meropenem. Although I would caution you with meropenem as sort of a blanket go-to agent here because it is fairly broad, and these patients are likely, if they're coming from the community and haven't been exposed to antibiotics recently, they shouldn't have multi-drug resistant gram-negative organisms. So something like cefepime plus metronidazole plus or minus vancomycin would be a good option, I think, in a penicillin allergic patient. And then if they had a severe penicillin allergy, ciprofloxacin or aztreonam plus metronidazole plus vancomycin for sure in those patients would be the right way to go.
Great. All right. So what about, do we need to cover MRSA or VRE or Candida routinely? How do you think about that?
In the IDSA intra-abdominal infection guidelines, they actually recommend against empiric coverage of MRSA, VRE, or Candida. The appropriate antibiotics should be started for these pathogens if they're isolated in culture. There's some caveats here. So MRSA should be started if the patient has a very superficial infection, if there's, if there's possible for the surgical wound to be involved, or if the patient has mesh in place, foreign bodies like you mentioned before. Empiric antifungal coverage should be started for patients with an esophageal perforation. And then there may be patients where you would consider fluconazole as a prophylactic strategy for invasive fungal infection. I think that's a little bit controversial in the literature, but something that you might consider in a patient that has a high severity of illness.
Okay, so we almost invariably, for kind of undifferentiated sepsis, right, we don't know the source, we start people on vancomycin, right? Are you suggesting that's not well supported, or are you saying if we know it's intra-abdominal, that's where we don't want to
go? I think if you know it's intra-abdominal, if you're pretty confident, the story just, it's pretty classic for a perforation, especially in the case we sort of talked about a little bit briefly where someone came in for an EGD and then had a subsequent perforation. In those patients, you can be pretty confident in the source. If you have a more complicated patient, someone who comes in after multiple courses of antibiotics, who maybe has an indwelling catheter for chemotherapy or for parenteral nutrition, these patients, it's much less clear. And in those patients where intra-abdominal is the most likely source, but there's also possible that they have a catheter-associated bloodstream infection or something like that, then vancomycin should be started empirically. But in those sort of classic examples where it's pretty straightforward, I think you can omit vancomycin because MRSA is not commonly a pathogen in the abdomen.
Okay. And then should we talk about, just maybe briefly, we do nasal staph screens. I'm sure probably most places do. Does whether or not your nasal staph screen is positive or negative play a role here?
There have been multiple studies that have demonstrated that in patients who are negative for MRSA colonization from a nasal swab, that their risk of an MRSA infection is extremely low, less than 2% even. And so I think if you have that information available, that can be helpful in your determination of whether or not MRSA coverage should be included in your empiric therapy. It's possible that in a patient newly admitted to the ICU, you're obtaining that swab at the same time that you're starting your empiric therapy, so you may not have that information. But if the swab does come back negative, that could be even more support. If you haven't recovered MRSA in culture and the screening swab is negative, that you could be pretty comfortable in discontinuing the vancomycin.
Great. So what do you think about duration of therapy for an intra-abdominal infection? How long do we need to keep these patients on antibiotics?
The duration of therapy can be guided by how rapid source control is obtained. In a trauma patient, for example, where source control is obtained immediately following an abdominal perforation, then probably 24 hours of perioperative antibiotics is reasonable, certainly not more than 48 hours. In patients who have frank contamination of their peritoneal cavity, So it maybe those are patients who haven't been given adequate bowel preparation, for example, or in patients in whom source control was not readily obtained. So someone who there were 12 hours or so, 12 to 24 hours between the time of probable perforation and source control achievement, those patients should probably be treated for 4 days. And we have good data from the paper that was recently published in the New England Journal in the last couple of years, the STOP-IT trial, to suggest that 4 days versus standard of care after obtainment of source control was not different with regard to reinfection.
So now let me ask you, because I know people are going to be saying, especially for the uncomplicated, and you're saying just 24 to 48 hours, they're going to be saying, what do you mean? Are you kidding me? We're going to stop antibiotics after a day? So let's say you have a patient who had a, you know, has an uncomplicated intra-abdominal infection, and you start treating them and they get worse. You probably aren't going to stop, right?
Agree.
Okay. So this is what we're saying, is that this is someone who has, for example, an operation, on their bowel or something. They have some spillage. They're fine clinically. You're treating them almost prophylactically. You don't have, they're certainly not bacteremic. This is just someone who you know had some bacteria spill in their abdomen, and so you're going to give them a day or two of antibiotics. If everything looks good, they're stable, they're not showing any signs of sepsis, they haven't had any positive blood cultures, that's when you would stop after a day or two.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, great. But interestingly, for even a complicated infection, that you can do just 4 days. But again, assuming that they're not getting worse.
Exactly. If you have a patient who's worsening, then there's probably a question, an underlying question of, is there a different source of infection, or is there just a lack of source control? Because the 4 days, the caveat there is after source control is achieved and you feel confident that source control has in fact been achieved. And so if that's not the case, then 4 days is probably not appropriate. And in patients who have severe immunosuppression, for example, those patients may also not be candidates for a 4-day course of therapy. But for a good majority of patients, 4 days is probably adequate.
Great. All right. Let's leave the abdomen and move on to another common infection, pneumonia. So up to the lungs. So how about community-acquired pneumonia in hospitalized patients? So they're coming in, they're bringing it with them. First of all, how do we know if it's community-acquired, and how do we think about that?
Yeah, so community-acquired pneumonia would be what you would call someone who presents to the hospital with pneumonia. So less than 48 hours after their admission to the hospital, patients that are coming from the community may have risk factors for Pseudomonas, but most of them do not. And in those patients who do not have risk factors for a pseudomonal infection, they should be treated with ceftriaxone plus azithromycin or moxifloxacin, for example, if they have a severe penicillin allergy. Patients may have risks for Pseudomonas, and in which case you would use cefepime instead of ceftriaxone in addition to azithromycin, or consider therapy for a severe penicillin allergy, perhaps aztreonam plus moxifloxacin. There are some other combinations that could be considered. And then you would narrow coverage if Pseudomonas is not present on culture. So then the next obvious question is, what puts someone at risk for having an infection with Pseudomonas?
Yes.
Even though they're coming from the community? And these would be patients who have a history of bronchiectasis, patients who have had a recent prolonged hospital stay of greater than 7 days, perhaps a debilitated nursing home resident, a patient who was recently mechanically ventilated for greater than 48 hours, patients who were recently on broad-spectrum antibiotics, and then patients who are immunocompromised, whether that be due to solid organ transplantation, a hematologic malignancy, bone marrow transplant, active chemotherapy, or corticosteroid use. I get a question often, how much corticosteroid means that you're immunocompromised? And typically the rule of thumb is patients who are on greater than the equivalent of prednisone 20 milligrams for more than 3 weeks.
Great. All right. So what about MRSA coverage? You said for intra-abdominal infections, we're not going to prophylactically do this. What about for pneumonia?
So for pneumonia, even for patients coming from the community, MRSA is a concern. So this is actually something that should largely be driven by the rates of MRSA that are seen at your institution. Here in Baltimore, for the most part, most patients don't require empiric MRSA coverage, but we would consider MRSA coverage in patients who we know to be colonized with MRSA. So if you have that nasal swab back and it's positive, or from a recent hospitalization, you know them to be positive, those are patients you would probably empirically have on MRSA coverage with vancomycin. Immunocompromised patients, and then also patients with evidence of necrotizing pneumonia with cavitation, particularly if it's associated with a preceding influenza-like illness, we know that's a risk factor for an MRSA pneumonia.
Great. Now, what about duration of therapy for pneumonia?
So for community-acquired pneumonia, 3 to 5 days is actually probably all that you need. And this would be for patients without immunocompromise or structural lung disease. For other patients, 7 days is probably a reasonable amount of time. This could include patients with moderate immunocompromise or patients even with structural lung disease. And then 10 to 14 days would really only be necessary in patients with poor clinical response who have received initial inappropriate therapy or who are significantly immunocompromised.
Great. All right. And then what about hospital-acquired pneumonia or ventilator-associated pneumonia? How do we think of that differently?
So we're with hospital-acquired pneumonia and ventilator-associated pneumonia, we're worried about different microorganisms. There were actually new guidelines published for HAP and VAP in September of 2016, so some relatively recent updates, and they identify risk factors for multidrug-resistant pathogens. The risk factors for multidrug-resistant VAP include prior IV antibiotic use within 90 days, septic shock at the time of VAP, ARDS preceding VAP, 5 or more days of hospitalization prior to the occurrence of VAP, and then acute renal replacement therapy prior to VAP. And the primary risk factor for multidrug-resistant hospital-acquired pneumonia, so HAP, would be prior intravenous antibiotic use within 90 days. So really, we're trying to identify, in these patients, we're really concerned about more resistant pathogens, not your typical community-acquired pathogens, which would be primarily strep, Haemophilus influenza, but here we would be worried about perhaps Pseudomonas and MRSA. So the guidelines recommend, recommend similar antibiotics for both HAP and VAP, and the treatment options include an anti-pseudomonal penicillin or cephalosporin, so an anti-pseudomonal penicillin being piptazo or an anti-pseudomonal cephalosporin being cefepime or ceftazidime, or a carbapenem, although, again, I issue my caution here that I wouldn't use a carbapenem as the first-line agent, but if you know that a patient has a history of a multidrug-resistant gram-negative infection or high MIC, then meropenem might be what you would reach for, or a monobactam like aztreonam. So these would be the primary agents, the sort of backbone of therapy, and then an agent with gram-positive gram-positive antibiotic with MRSA activity, so either vancomycin or linezolid would be preferred here. And then they do provide some guidance for when you might consider double covering gram-negative infections, and that's really based upon resistance rates at your institution. So if you have more than 10% resistance to Pseudomonas, with that has greater than 10% resistance to one of the anti-pseudomonal penicillins or cephalosporins, or the carbapenem, for example, then you might add a fluoroquinolone or an aminoglycoside. Again, this is really institution-specific, when you might choose selecting one of those agents and which agent to select, which would really give you some additional coverage. For example, at our institution, adding ciprofloxacin to an anti-pseudomonal penicillin or cephalosporin would not provide you any additional coverage, and so that's not part of what our algorithm for treatment would be.
Okay. So, Rachel, sometimes we get things back on a BAL or certainly a sputum sample that grow out and we don't want to treat them. We say they're just colonizers. What do you generally think of as common colonizers that you wouldn't normally treat?
Generally, we consider Enterococcus and Candida species as colonizing organisms, and they don't generally require treatment. So for the most part, those organisms don't need to be targeted with your empiric or definitive therapy.
Great. And what do you think about duration of therapy for hospital-acquired or ventilator-associated pneumonia?
For most patients, 7 days is appropriate. If symptoms persist at 7 days, you might consider an alternative source and or considering a bronchoscopy with quantitative cultures at that point. There's a caveat to that, though. So in patients who have VAP with associated MRSA, bacteremia should be treated for at least 14 days, and that would be the minimum after ruling out endocarditis or seeding of other sites. But in general, for most patients who have a gram-negative or a gram-positive organism that's not MRSA, 7 days is the appropriate duration of therapy.
Great. All right, let's turn to urinary tract infections. So often we see these as catheter-associated infections in the hospital. How do you think about catheter-associated UTIs?
I think the first thing to think about when diagnosing a urinary tract infection is whether or not the patient actually has a urinary tract infection, or do they in fact just have asymptomatic bacteriuria. So both a urine analysis and a urine culture are vital for the diagnosis of a catheter-associated UTI. And in fact, a reflexive approach is something that many institutions are trying in order to not over-treat or over-diagnose and subsequently over-treat asymptomatic bacteriuria. And what I mean by asymptomatic bacteriuria is a positive urine culture with no other signs and symptoms of infection. In this case, no antibiotics are indicated unless the patient is pregnant, the patient is post-renal transplant or about to undergo a urologic procedure, or if they're neutropenic. The treatment here really is just to remove the catheter.
Great. And so let's say you can't remove the catheter or you need the patient to have a Foley. Then should you change the Foley to a new one and treat? Or what do you recommend doing if you have to have a Foley in and they have what you think is asymptomatic bacteriuria?
I think probably you can continue to monitor the patient, change the Foley if you can, but probably you can continue to monitor and until you see signs or symptoms of infection. I think we sometimes over-treat the presence of bacteria in the urine without these other signs and symptoms. A catheter-associated urinary tract infection is characterized by signs and symptoms including fever or rigors with no other source, with potentially new onset delirium, malaise, or lethargy with no other source, and suprapubic or flank pain. In addition, it requires the presence of pyuria and a positive urine culture. So this would be greater than 5 to 10 white blood cells per high-powered field, and then also a urine culture with greater than 1,000 colony-forming units per ml.
Okay, and so if you have that, then how do you treat?
In those patients, in patients who are stable with no evidence of upper tract disease, again, removing the catheter if possible, and without evidence of upper tract disease, you could consider monitoring alone. Often in these patients, especially if they're sick in the ICU, if they do have evidence of no upper tract disease, but in fact it appears that they have cystitis, we will often treat them. And we would use an agent like ceftriaxone, for example. In a patient with a severe penicillin allergy, perhaps ciprofloxacin would be your alternative agent. But again, looking at your institution or even unit-specific antibiogram would be helpful. In a patient who's severely ill, or in a patient with evidence of upper tract disease, or a patient who's been hospitalized for a longer duration of time, greater than 48 hours, then you might use a broader agent. An anti-pseudomonal cephalosporin is probably the most optimal, at least by our susceptibilities, or our antibiogram, I should say, here.
So that would be like cefepime.
Cefepime would be a good option here. And for a severe penicillin allergic patient, aztreonam would be a good option.
And when you say upper tract disease, you're talking about involvement of the kidneys.
Exactly.
Okay. And how would that present? More severe illness, more rigors and fevers?
Yes. More systemic signs of infection. Exactly. So fever, an elevated white blood cell count, perhaps they would have rigors. And these patients might present with urosepsis, and we try to catch it before that occurs. But certainly if a patient presented with urosepsis, using a broader agent like cefepime would be optimal.
Great. And how long do you treat for?
7 days is typically the duration of therapy that you would need here.
Great. All right. So let's say, Rachel, let's just talk through a case. Let's say you've got a 58-year-old woman with ulcerative colitis, and she's in the ED with worsening abdominal pain despite being on 5 days of antibiotics. She gets a CT scan, which shows some free air in her abdomen, and they call surgery. And then she goes to the OR, has lysis of adhesions and a hemicolectomy. And then she ends up in the ICU, and she's got a discontinuous bowel. Her abdomen is still open. She's sedated. What do you want to know? What would you be saying to us when we ask you how we should treat, or if we should treat?
Yeah, so some of the first questions that I would ask is, what did it look like in there? Were the surgeons able to obtain source control? What did you find? If if the answer was that you found a perforated ileus, something like that, a perforated small bowel with gross fecal contamination, I would ask if we were able to obtain peritoneal cultures to see if that would help us guide therapy in the future. I would also try to assess whether or not we had source control, that being the biggest thing. So the duration of therapy would probably be dependent on whether or not we obtain source control, but probably it's not going to change empiric therapy a lot if we know she had gross contamination and had previously been on antibiotics and presents in the way that you described with a high severity of illness.
All right, so let's say that they didn't place any drains because her abdomen is open. She's got a wound back on. They thought, well, no, we don't think we got it all. We're probably going to have to take her back for a further washout tomorrow. And she came from home. And right now, she's actually hemodynamically unstable. She's on pressor. She's got a white count of 25. She's still febrile. What would you be asking at this point?
So the things that I would want to know in order to decide what antibiotic therapy, because it sounds like it's pretty obvious that this patient is in shock and presumably septic shock. So I would want to know what antibiotics the patient received at home before she came in, and if she had any drug allergies that we needed to be concerned about.
So let's say she was on ciprofloxacin and metronidazole at home. Would we continue that, or would we choose something else?
So I think we would definitely choose something else, especially given that resistance can occur pretty quickly for patients who are receiving fluoroquinolones. I would want to know, so the fact that she was receiving cipro and flagyl, it could be because it's convenient and there's some data for use in patients who have inflammatory bowel disease. But I would want to make sure that she didn't have a severe penicillin allergy and that be part of the reason why she was receiving cipro and flagyl. So that would be something to really, really important to hash out. If she didn't have a penicillin allergy, I would probably start with our sort of go-to option, which would be piperacillin tazobactam. In a patient who presents with this high severity of illness, who's recently been on antibiotics, especially if she had any previous lines in place, I would add vancomycin empirically until we sorted out exactly what is going on.
Great. So that sounds good. Now, what if she did have a severe penicillin allergy?
So if she had a life-threatening penicillin allergy, then I would probably avoid any beta-lactams. So if a history of anaphylaxis would sort of have me consider not ciprofloxacin because she was on that recently, but estreonam instead. So I would use estreonam and metronidazole for gram-negative and anaerobic coverage, vancomycin for gram-positive coverage, because remember, estreonam doesn't have any. And then considering her high severity of illness, I might add an aminoglycoside, knowing that at our institution, we have some holes in the pseudomonal coverage and other gram-negative coverage when we think about estreonam. If she had a mild penicillin allergy, if you told me that she had a rash as a child when she received penicillin, then I wouldn't have any concern with re-challenging with something like cefepime plus metronidazole, and I would add vancomycin to that probably as well.
Great. And then because we haven't got definitive source control yet, we're not going to start counting days of therapy. Is that right? We're going to wait until they get definitive source control, get everything cleaned out, and then start counting.
Exactly.
And how long would you treat once source control is in place?
Once source control is in place, given the fact that she's not immunocompromised came from home, once we have source control and we know that we're on the appropriate antibiotics based on our culture data, then I think 4 days of therapy post-source control would be appropriate.
Great. All right. Well, thanks for going over that case, Rachel, and thanks for coming in to do part two of Bugs and Drugs. Any last thing you want to add before we close?
I don't think so. Thanks for having me.
All right. Thanks so much. All right, folks. That was Rachel Kruer, pharmacist extraordinaire. Really a great two-part series there. If you have any comments, please leave them at acrac.com. That's ACCRAC.com. Let us know, how do you handle intra-abdominal infections or pneumonia or bladder infections in the ICU? Do you have any different experience? And we can all learn from what you have to share. You can also, of course, always get a hold of me, acrac@acrac.com. If you haven't, or you haven't in a while, please consider either going or going again to iTunes and leaving a comment and a rating about the show. It really helps others find the show, and we really appreciate it. And of course, if you are interested in supporting the making of the show, you can go to patreon.com/acrac, that's patreon.com/accrac, where you can become a patron of the show. And even just a dollar or two can make a big difference in helping support the making of the show. Thank you so much. All right, that's it for today for the ACRAC podcast and Rachel Kruer. I'm Jed Wolpaw. Remember, what you're doing out there every day is really important and valued.